Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Dr. Jacob Kendall. Dr. Jacob Kendall demystifies healthcare. He is the survivor of two open heart surgeries in early adulthood and has formal training in gerontology, public health, social work, biology, and theology. Jacob believes the key to mastering health and being a savvy patient or caregiver is a convergent four-dimensional approach, integrating multiple perspectives to show that health and healthcare are more than individualistic, medical, here and now. He is a former professor of social work and global health as well. It is my pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Thanks, Dave. I'm glad to be here and we'll have a good conversation.
And your background is so interdisciplinary. It wouldn't be much of a jump with some training in maybe law or some other aspect of end-of-life care, where you could probably jump into the role of a bioethicist very seamlessly.
Yeah. the more education I've gotten, the more experiences that I've had and things that other people who know me well have said, I think that I would do very well in law school and very well in that environment. And if I were going to live 150 more years, I can easily think of more education I'd rather get. I'm in a program right now to get my fifth degree. It's way too much education, but it's just fun for me. But if I were going to do something else, it would definitely be a law degree. And even without that, bioethics, you know, you can't be a responsible gerontologist or chronic disease advocate like I am without thinking of bioethical issues. So I agree with what you just said, and that makes sense.
And yeah, one of the things that that came across very clear in our intro conversation is that you are very much an advocate. You have that in your voice, you have that in your demeanor, and that you are advocating for a different approach to healthcare than we are known for in the society. And you mentioned that you have a convergent four-dimensional approach. What does that four-dimensional approach entail?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, it's very difficult for me. I'm getting better at it, but to convey that in a short amount of time, I'm continuing to work on that. And so I'm not sure that that's the main focus of today. It would probably take up a good bit of our time, but to get the best summary I can, go back to the interdisciplinary piece. I've been told that interdisciplinary is a term that is largely academic and it doesn't travel well outside of the academy. And I was raised in the academy. You know, you get your PhD usually to go and teach and do research. And I worked in higher ed for several years, but I've been trying to come up with a term that means the same thing that translates well outside of academia. The best one I've come up with so far is multidimensional. What I mean by that, but either interdisciplinary or multidimensional, is that basically we're going to do the best at solving any problems. And I just happen to focus on health and healthcare because of my own personal experiences, which I know we'll get into. So the best approach to really moving forward in a good way with health, and that includes healthcare, is using multiple perspectives. So we need to be able to zoom in and out. You know, I think American individualism is running amok. We need to be able to consider other perspectives other than just medicine. Physicians don't know everything. We should not expect them to know everything. And any physician that's worth their salt will tell you that they don't know everything. So we need these other perspectives. That's two dimensions. And we should consider it's basically, I get it from space time, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And so, you know, I love comparing as a global health scholar, I love comparing, health outcomes between different states in the U.S. or between different countries, we need to consider the geographic component of it as well. So that's the third dimension. I live in the Southeast. This is the stroke belt. We have higher rates of heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. So geographic component. And then the time component is the health is not just right now. We need to think about it futuristically. One of my favorite examples to give is, and again, this comes from being a gerontologist, Americans are really bad at, and maybe just humans in general, really bad at planning ahead. We're getting into a time in which no one is going to be unaffected if they're not already. No one is going to be unaffected by caregiving, chronic disease, issues with healthcare. We're not very good at getting life insurance early, planning for our own dying and death and our people who will survive us, wills, powers of attorney, et cetera. I think it's getting better, but we're not there yet. So those are the four dimensions. I know that's it's still hard for me to give the elevator speech on it, but I'm working on it.
Well, I think that's a nice overview, and I think will be a nice segue in terms of what we're going to be talking about later in the podcast. But I do believe that I think the trend is going to be towards more integrative medicine. I don't think any one discipline can account for the plethora of problems that individuals may present with at a variety of different levels. And I think we need to be flexible in terms of kind of an eclectic approach. What Western medicine can't account for, perhaps holistic spiritual perspectives or approaches, can pick up the slack. So,
and macro perspectives. That's what I meant by zooming in and out. Again, as someone trained in public health, I'm always going to say we have to be able to look at this from a population level as well. And there are different levels of that too. So I agree with you. And the eclectic means both this way and that way, up and down and left to right.
And I think the macro approach, I think, emphasizes the importance of community and community support and community resources in terms of contributing to a holistic health perspective. So as somebody that has also an MSW or Master's in Social Work, we talked a lot about the macro perspective in graduate school, and that sense of community is so crucial to any type of social problem or healthcare issue that we're facing. So.
When I say that American individualism is run amok, I think we don't embrace that enough. Mm-hmm. We still, you get things like, oh, well, I don't want to support policies that help people with obesity because those people are just choosing to eat too much. Or I don't want to support any kind of socialized medicine because I will lose my individual choice and provider. And if we stay on that level, then first of all of that is incorrect. That's false. Those are illusions. But if we just stay on that level, then we're not going to get to where we want with health. And so individual level health is important, but health is familial. It's community, it's population, it's national, it's global. So I could wax philosophical for a while. So I'll pause there, but it should be very eclectic.
Yep. I agree. I know you mentioned earlier that a lot of your personal experiences that you've had have shaped your passions today. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the experiences that have shaped your passions about doing healthcare differently today?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, the typical ones that are true of many people are, getting married, becoming a parent. Those are going to be the obvious ones that have a major impact and change my outlook on life. The ones that not everyone experiences that are relevant for me is, you mentioned that I've had two open heart surgeries. The second one in particular has been very, very impactful. Many things have changed and shifted about my life since that point. And I don't think that that's the only variable contributing to all those changes, but it's without a doubt, it certainly is one of the major ones. And not just the physical component of it. Right now I'm on blood thinners, and that's a big game changer for me. I have to just keep a harder look on my heart health, and nothing only ever affects your heart. It always affects more of your body, but beyond the physical and medical components, it's just, any aspect of well-being that you can think of. In some ways goes back to that. Another one is having been a family caregiver, that shows you a yet another side of our healthcare system, and having to plan for that and everything that, that goes into that. You know, my dad had a debilitating heart attack and stroke, and my wife and I completely uprooted our original plans to go help her, my mom, care for him. And not only was it the, you know, the rehab and the help and getting caregivers in, but it was also trying to get power of attorney, trying to sell their house and move all of us. And so, like I said, none of this happens in a vacuum. And I guess the third piece, and it's not a singular event in this case, but I've traveled all over the world, and it was back in 2010 in particular when I visited several different countries on three different continents. It was a service learning trip. And in particular, a couple of countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Ethiopia and Uganda. That's when I decided, you know what? I want to go into public health. I want to focus on this more macro component. Because at that point, I was like, should I be a clinician or should I, you know, as public health? I was very early stages considering that. And that did a lot for me as well. You really can't travel, especially as you go to more off the beaten path, so-called exotic places. There's no way to have those experiences without being changed. So those are three that come to mind in terms of personal experiences that have had a lot of impact.
Yeah, particularly you've experienced it from both sides as also a patient who's had two open heart surgeries and also a caregiver for a parent who had a debilitating injury. So you've seen the yin and the yang of our current healthcare and Western medicine from both sides of that. I think particularly your travels to other countries too, I think had to impact your perspective in terms of how we do healthcare, how we should do healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the yin and the yang. And of course, there's more than two sides to healthcare. And I have very little clinical experience, but having the social work degree, you know, you learn about therapy and mental health. I have worked in a hospital many years ago, and I have very frank and honest discussions. That's redundant. Frank and sometimes blunt discussions with my medical providers. And so I obviously can't fully see it from that third perspective, but I've got enough of a taste to know that there's that side of things as well. I mean, I used to blame my doctors because I just thought that they were trying to bring in more patients and have an inefficient system in order for them to have more money for themselves. But over time, when I would complain about health insurance companies, they were right there with me. And so I think that our medical industrial complex does not do the best for our providers as well. So I've gotten a different perspective that way. And, you know, traveling around the world, you talk to people about the healthcare systems in these other countries, you talk to them about the experiences that they have. And I mean, quite frankly, on the one hand, I don't want to make this political, but we are in an election year. And this tendency to think that we're so star-spangled awesome is really missing what a lot of other people in other parts of the world experience. I think that's very illusory. So absolutely, there are many ways in which traveling to other parts of the world have helped illuminate things for me.
Well, and the other thing, as somebody who worked as a clinician in the human service field, I had to deal with managed care companies all the time. And it's important that we know what their lingo is, what requirements are looking for, to be able to at least present, you know, clinical data in a way that's going to ensure that individuals are going to get quality care. But that's the other piece of it. I know there's a lot of frustration with a lot of the HMOs because of their requirements. And, I think it's important for us to learn to adapt to that, whether we're clinicians or healthcare professionals, so that we can, in some sense, provide some semblance of quality care. But we could spend probably another two podcasts talking about those type of inconsistencies in terms of coverage or coverage requirements. So that is a frustrating piece for a lot of individuals who are trying to get healthcare, is trying to navigate those requirements that their HMOs have. One of the things we talked about during our pre-chat is the importance of spiritual care as it relates to healthcare. So I'd like to kind of explore that with you for a little bit. So from your perspective, what does spiritual care as it relates to healthcare involve? And does the nature of spiritual care depend on how the client defines spirituality?
I might have to get you to repeat that second question, but I'll go ahead and take a look at the first. And you mentioned that I'm studying theology. You know, I'm at the point where I don't need any more education, but this has always been a personal interest of mine. And you know, it's not that hard to find the intersection because, again, as a responsible gerontologist, most people die in older age. Most people die of chronic disease. You know, I wouldn't be professionally responsible if I just were a gerontologist, but I avoided thinking about end of life and issues around dying and death. And questions about faith and spirituality and religion come up for a lot of people during that period of life in ways that are different than how they've been processed in different in other stages of life. And that's not true for everyone. That's kind of the point, right? That when you say health, when you say spiritual health, when you say financial health, anything, none of it is completely universal. At least for a lot of people, if not everyone, spiritual health is an important thing. Again, it's really fascinating to look at that when it comes to end of life issues, not just for the people who are dying, but for their family members to process that. I mean, we're at a time right now where cancer used to be the really scary word, but now it's dementia. Totally understandable. The older the populations get, the more prevalence there is of dementia. I often say, half jokingly, completely seriously, that dementia is a pretty terrible gift to have for a longer life. Okay, it really challenges people. You know, when you look at someone and their personality is completely different, or they don't remember you at all. I can't enumerate the number of times that I've read about or even known personally about adult children seeing this happen to their older parents, and it really profoundly affects their worldview. And that's only going to become more and more common. So spiritual health is definitely, it's really, really important. And that's just making a generalized kind of obvious statement. But is it obvious enough? Because again, going back to healthcare being more than medical, I don't think that health is as holistic as it can and should be right now. You know, I think, you know, in hospitals, you have chaplains and whatnot, and that's really important work, but why do their salaries suck? Why is that not considered a more valuable service? It should be. And I also think that faith leaders should be seen as valuable components of the healthcare system. I'm now living back in my home state of Alabama, but I'll give a shout out real quick. My most recent faculty gig was teaching global health at Mercer University in Central Georgia. And Mercer has it's based in Macon, but they have medical school campuses in several other Georgia cities. And they have this, it's called the Rural Health Innovation Center. And one of the projects that someone in that center is working on in rural areas is how do we get faith leaders and medical providers to work alongside one another, which is probably even more important in rural areas because you don't have as many specialists and the issues that people face in rural areas are different than those in urban areas. So there are these kind of isolated initiatives going on that I think are going to give us really good models for how it can be on a wider scale. So those are kind of a couple things that come to mind when you ask me about the importance of spiritual health. Like anything else, we can go an entire conversation on that point alone, but I'll pause there. And if I didn't answer your second question, let me know.
I think it did, because I think essentially you mentioned that, you know, the definition of spirituality varies for individuals. I mean, everybody has a, you know, depending on their background, depending on their own experiences, how they see spirituality is going to be very individualistic. But I agree that there needs to be collaboration between faith leaders, the medical community, the human service profession. That certainly would emphasize a process of collaboration and integrative approaches. I think that would be an excellent model for that. But I think there's more room for us to become more interdisciplinary and not so much just be separate in what we're doing. It's like we're doing parallel paths, but we're not coming together for the overall benefit of a client. So I would agree with that. That type of collaboration is important. Plus the other thing, I believe JACO, the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospital Organizations, they require that in order to do holistic treatment, you have to do some type of spiritual assessment or spirituality assessment. Even if the client doesn't want to go anywhere with spirituality or doesn't show an interest other than just beyond the superficial evaluation, we still have to offer that as part of holistic treatment and bring that up with the client if the door opens again. So we really can't do holistic treatment without talking about some form of spirituality or a person's sense of spirituality or religiosity.
Yeah. And here's a confessional moment for me. Even as recently as going into and in the first part of my seminary journey, it's a 4-year program and I just started my 4th year. I had a hard time, an increasingly difficult time over the past several years, seeing the future value, shall we say, of theologians and other such folks, because I mean, there are trends in secularization. There are a growing percentage of Americans, a growing number of Americans who don't affiliate with any kind of religious tradition. But one thing that I have more recently come to believe is that even though we live in an increasingly pluralistic society, including pluralistically religious, I think that theologians and ministers, one way in which they can play a very valuable role is basically screaming at the top of their lungs to show that, you know what, there's this kind of value in human life that is not inherent to the way that our medical systems run. I mean, it's a consumer-based capitalistic for-profit industry, which means that the bottom line is always going to be making money. And I think that, bottom line, our medical industrial complex does better when Americans are sick rather than well. And we need to accept that and come to terms with that. And I don't think that the way it's designed values human life to the max. And of course, we can have individual providers. I have excellent physicians. Some of my providers are awesome. They go to bat for me. They're in my corner. And they do great work. But again, this is also a systemic issue. And so if theologians and ministers are among those, and I believe largely they are, that are saying, listen, human life is valuable. And the way that it's being, the way that the human body is treated in our medical system right now does not reflect the value that humans have, then we need more people saying that. And if ministers and theologians are saying that, then they need to be in the public space making that very, very clear. And so that's an important role that I think moving forward, religious folk can have a very valuable say in, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense to me. And I think you're absolutely right. In the medical profession, patients are almost expected to assume the sick role, which implies a lot of different things. Sick implies being debilitated and debilitation, as opposed to what strengths does that individual have that we can nurture to allow them to be autonomous in the middle of sickness. And the other thing, Jacob, that comes up, especially if you're looking at end of life, are all these existential spiritual concerns. You know, what's going to happen to me after I die? What's going to happen to my family after I die? Have I lived a quality life? Have I made an impact? All of these questions are going to come up, particularly during that end of life chapter, and I think for anybody, whether it's in the medical profession, healthcare profession, or any other type of human service profession, to neglect that is a disservice to the client, because we are not giving that client an opportunity or empower that client to make a statement at their end of life in terms of the impact that their life had. And in the middle of sickness, we have to emphasize quality of life. however that is defined.
Yeah, I think we do a very bad job of end-of-life care in many ways. One of my favorite quote, I think, is by the former British Prime Minister William Gladstone. It was some decades ago. I'm paraphrasing here, but it's basically, we can tell how compassionate a society is toward its living people by observing the way in which that society treats dead bodies. So if they do it very with a lot of compassion, then that means that they'll treat living humans like that is with compassion as well. And I think that we can take one step back from that and say, show me the way that a society treats people at the end of their lives, and that will be a reflection of how the society treats all people in that society. And I agree with you, regardless of what my beliefs are, your beliefs are, the doctor's belief are. I mean, it's social work, right? Meet them where they are. And if they're having these questions, then they deserve, as a right, the basic human right, they deserve the opportunity to process and reflect on that.
Absolutely. I mean, we exist to meet the client's needs as the client defines those needs. It's very self-determined. And if we attempt to impose our value system or beliefs on that client, that borders on unethical care.
Because it's not going to go well either.
No. I've never been a person, Jacob, that's like to have been told that this is how things have to be. Because no, things don't have to be the way you are telling me they have to be, because how you see them having to be is based on your own perception of the world. You need to be able to hold space for my perception of the world, as I need to be able to hold space for yours, so that we can understand each other and we can align where we can align and respect the differences where those differences exist. That in and of itself, us creating space for each other, is a powerful, powerful statement. It's a powerful statement. Plus, it's a spiritual experience in and of itself.
Yeah, I know. In the same way that I was just saying that the way that we treat people at the end of life is a reflection for how we do things in general. The light bulb just went off for me in the way that you worded what you just said. But, you know, meeting somewhere where they are is the epitome of empathy. That is the definition of empathy. And I think something we're having a hard time with in this country right now with arguably the deepest ideological polarization that we've ever seen is that I think a lot of people conflate understanding someone else's perspective with agreeing with that perspective. And they're not the same thing, right? You know, I think that we can better understand ourselves by understanding the other. I don't know, like, one thing that I love about gerontology and studying aging is that if we envision a society that is ideal for older adults and even ideal for people at the end of their lives, then that's a society that's going to benefit everyone. And this idea of empathy, meeting them where they are and understanding, seeking to understand their perspective better, is so foundational to that goal. I like the way that you just worded. That's what came to mind when you were just saying that.
Yeah. And the other thing, and I'm glad you said what you said about older individuals, because I'm an older individual. I'm a senior. And a lot of times, many in Western society think after individuals reach a certain age, they no longer have value. And I tell my students at Utica University, you want to really learn a lot about life and history, sit down with an older person. Sit down with somebody 75, 80 years old. They've lived 8 decades. They can give you 8 decades of history. They have stories. And the world will come alive through their stories. And they have a lot of wisdom within those stories. So sit down with an older person and let them just tell you about their lives. Let them tell you about their times and let them tell you about their experiences.
And you see projects right now. Again, it's isolated incidents around the country, around the world of let's go and interview older adults and go ahead and tap into their repository of wisdom before they no longer can give that. And sometimes we learn the only way we can learn about this small town or this language or this event in history is by interviewing those individuals. And as always, I agree with what you just said. We should be doing more of that, but it happens the macro level as well. You mentioned, we tend to view them as being economically dependent. And that's how it is in most of the primary macroeconomic concepts like GDP and things like that. Children and older adults are counted as being dependents. But if we were to financially, if we were to enumerate, to quantify the financial impact or the quantitative amount of economic benefit that older adults play, it would be in the billions of dollars because of free babysitting, because of volunteering, et cetera. But that's not accounted for. And it's baffling to me that that's the case.
Yeah. And just in terms of just to dovetail off of it, just in terms of the money that we spend on healthcare in our last year of life, I was reading a statistic that we spend more money on healthcare in the last year of life than we do at any other time. And that's the time where doctors who, really have, they have a very, I will say, ambivalent relationship with death. They take it personally. They're going to impress upon families and the patient, let's do these procedures with the hope that we're going to shorten your time here, but for hope we're going to get time on the back end. And particularly, and Jacob, for somebody who is dying, doing those procedures, particularly during the last week of their life, doesn't improve quality of life, and it's more stressful for the caregivers to see that.
And it decreases their chances of dying in their own home, which the vast majority of people want to do, completely understandably. They're hooked up to machines. They have all these tests. And, I think this is a conversation for bioethicists. Things like physician-assisted dying. When you call it physician-assisted suicide, obviously it's going to have the negative connotation to it. I think it should be called physician-assisted dying, regardless of what one's beliefs about that are. Mm-hmm. I don't like the fact that there are certain issues and topics that are considered to be a conversation stopper. And I think that that's one of them. Even if we do come to the political and social decision to not have certain practices like that be legalized, I still firmly and fully believe that an openness to having a discussion about it will be more likely to get us to the solution that we want. But I it's very clear because of what you just said right now, that we spend so much money and have all these tests at the end of life, it's very clear that what we have now is not the answer.
And as far as aid in dying legislation, I think there's 11 states in the union now that will legislate aid in dying. For me, in being somebody who was an emotional caregiver to a daughter who, and I call it, transitioned from cancer over 21 years ago, not that she would have wanted an aid in dying option because she wanted to spend time with her family and as much time as she could, knowing what the circumstances were. Looking back on that experience, if somebody came up to me and said, I want to move to a state. Well, I'm in upstate New York, so Vermont would be probably the closest that has aid in dying legislation. I'd want to move to Vermont, establish residency, and see if I could be eligible for death with dignity. I wouldn't blame them in a heartbeat, because if that's an option that they wish to explore, who am I to say no? And I believe aid in dying should be an option in all 50 states, an option that is an option to explore in addition to other healthcare options that we already have available. We should offer that as a viable option. And again, providing that it's well regulated, it's well structured, and there's consistent guidelines, why not?
Yeah. And, going back to what I said about a conversation starter, and this is tied to the point that I also mentioned earlier about this very stark ideological polarization that we're experiencing. So a conversation starter means that if it's not this, then nothing else is worth talking about. And so we have basically two options. We consider aid in dying, or we consider not having that at all. And those are the two options, but it's a spectrum. Like, somewhere in this spectrum is the answer that we need. But we cannot discover that unless we're willing to have a conversation about both ends of that spectrum. And so I don't know what the answer is as far as aid in dying. And I don't know what, I agree with you that it should be nationwide, that we should be more open to it. But I in the very least, what I do firmly believe is that as long as we avoid talking about that issue, as long as we avoid death in general, as long as people don't want to think about their embrace their own mortality, then we are not going to find the answers that we need to these problems. I'm very convicted about that point. We avoid death in so many ways. And it seems counterintuitive, but I contend that the more that we embrace our own mortality, the higher our quality and quantity of life will be in general.
Well, absolutely. Because once we realize that this incarnation of ourselves in this world is temporary, and we understand that death is a part of our existence, we're going to do more to try to make a more meaningful life and a more impactful life. We're going to say the things that we need to say. We're going to treat people the way we want to be treated. We're not going to leave anything unsaid between us. We're going to live life to the fullest, that we're going to try to make an impact through service. But I think you're right. I mean, many in society have a fear of death. They don't want to talk about it until it's upon them. Well, the time to talk about it is before it's upon you. Realize that it's going to be a part of your life. And if you treat it that way, that could also be a profound opportunity for growth, for spiritual growth, for personal growth, and professional growth as well, too, because all of that type of attitude that we can foster within ourselves to live a meaningful life while we have the opportunity to do that is going to come out in everything that we do in all categories of our lives.
Yeah. I mean, you can focus on just financial health alone and see that that's true. We like I said, we're really bad at it planning ahead. And I think we're seeing changes now. I mean, my grandfather, who's in his 90s now, he has said before that one of the reasons he didn't plan ahead is because he didn't expect to live this long, which was reasonable. When he was born, his life expectancy was well below what it is now. So I do think we're getting better at realizing that, hey, we're living long, we got to plan for it. But what we mostly see right now is that in avoiding embracing our own mortality, we don't plan for that. And we run out of money when we're in older age, even though we might have years, if not decades, ahead of us. There's a strong relationship between aging and not having enough wealth to survive. So even financially, if we just think about that way alone, embracing our mortality can help us be in a better place and enjoy life more in older age.
Absolutely. And I think the more engaged that we can become as we get older, I don't know if there's any research on this, Jacob, but I think there's a correlation between engagement in life, financial health, having all of the dimensions in order.
There's tons of research on it.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And I think the more that we engage in life, the longer we live, and the longer we live a good quality life.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many ways in which that's studied. Having good relationships with family, having things that you go to socially, having friends, having hobbies, going to volunteer, all these different things, continuing to learn, read, etc. Yeah, there's tons of research on that.
Well, I'll tell you, we could probably go on for about another 2 hours just with all of these other dimensions, but we're getting close to our time to end, unfortunately. Hopefully we can do this again down the road, but I do have a couple more questions for you, if you're ready for them. The first is, if you're going to leave our listeners with one thing today, what would that be?
Well, I feel like we've talked a lot about what kind of a more ideal society would look like. And frankly, that can seem very overwhelming. And I'll be completely honest. I do identify as a chronic disease and healthcare advocate. And with all my lifelong experiences dealing with healthcare, you know, push came to shove, so I'm shoving back. These are the things that I do. But there are also days, right? There are also times when I'm like, man, these problems are intractable. I don't feel like doing this, right? And so I want to, like, learning to embrace your mortality, learning to be more assertive with your physicians, learning to practice self-advocacy when you're knee-deep, neck-deep in the muddy waters of caregiving, whatever these experiences are, know that learning to face those with more introspection with, you know, doing the best that you can. These are skills that you have to build. And so practice grace on yourself for not always getting it right. If you're a caregiver and you have a day when you just don't have the energy, and you're not being the best care of that person, then just practice grace on yourself because it's okay. Right. We talked about ideals throughout this conversation, but those ideals are something to reach for. I'm not sure we'll ever attain them, but if you can be a little bit better tomorrow than you are today, then that's going somewhere. So learn to practice grace on yourself. Learn that getting to these points is skills that we have to build. And most people get into older age and they're not there yet. Keep learning until you're done, right? So I would just say that. Practice grace on yourself and life's a process.
Absolutely. And as I get older, and I'll be 70 in 2025, I'm still learning, Jacob. I'm learning from young adults. I'm learning from older adults. I'm learning from the world around me. And that growth process should never be stagnant. It should always be ongoing. And I want to continue to grow until I enter another dimension, another state of existence. So that's sage advice and sage wisdom. So thank you for sharing that. You're welcome. And my final question is, if people want to get in touch with you, contract for your services, find out what you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. These days, what I spend most of my time on is doing speaking and workshops and consulting around these very issues that we've been discussing. I talk about and help folks at the individual and family levels to be more assertive, squeeze more juice out of your medical care and be better caregivers. And then on the more macro side, you know, that's where I talk about four-dimensional health and how we need public health and other macro level responses to these issues. And so my website is just jacobevanskendall.com. Evans is Evans, KENDALL, jacobevanskendall.com. And, you know, go check that out. And I'm also very active on LinkedIn, also Jacob Evans Kendall on LinkedIn. So those are two ways that someone can reach me, and I'd love to chat with you if you want to continue these conversations. So yeah, thanks for asking about that.
Oh, you're welcome. And Jacob, thank you for being a valuable guest contributor today on the Teaching Journeys podcast. I truly enjoyed our conversation today.
Yeah, likewise. I appreciate the invite.
You're welcome. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.